Support for Science Friday comes from R2C Group. R2C Group crafts TV advertising that's as effective and measurable as your digital and search marketing while helping to build your brand. That's right, TV advertising that generates trackable sales. Learn more at craftplusmath.com. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to chat with astronaut Scott Kelly from the International Space Station and his twin brother Mark right here on the ground. We're going to talk about living and working in space. But first, you're probably well aware of the ability of viruses to cause cancer. Human papillomavirus, for example, which causes near all cases of cervical cancer. But something we hear less about is using viruses to fight cancer. In this case, using the herpes virus to kill skin cancer. It's one of the stories my next guest wrote about this week. She's here to talk about it and other selected short subjects in science. Rachel Feltman runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. She's back with us here in our New York studios. Good to see you, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me again, Ira.
Tell us about this herpes and skin cancer.
Yeah, so this was a phase 3 clinical trial, which means it's really just waiting for FDA approval before it goes on the market. And it's this modification of the herpes simplex 1 virus, which is known for causing cold sores and some cases of genital herpes. And it's the first time that an immunotherapy using a virus has gotten this far in success for treating cancer. And what it does is herpes is really good at proliferating within cells and then bursting them. So T-VEC has a couple genetic modifications, first of all, so that it doesn't proliferate in healthy cells. Only cancer cells don't recognize it and allow it to spread. And secondly, in addition to bursting and destroying those cells, it also sends out a kind of red flag to the immune system. So the immune system knows to go attack the melanoma tumors. And it was really successful. And it could be, you know, the first of a lot of virus-based therapies for cancers.
Especially melanoma, which is a tough one to fight.
Right. In fact, when they started this clinical trial, there was really no standard of treatment for melanoma. And now there is, so they're going to go back and compare T-VEC to some of the other options. But even just a few years ago, this was really, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a whole new way of fighting cancer now. They're using a lot of different viruses,
mm-hmm.
aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that's how you get inside and attack it.
Yeah, well, viruses are really good at what they do, and harnessing that is going to change medicine a lot.
Let's talk about your second story, which is a fossil find by a really unlikely guy, right?
Right. Well, the funny thing is that he is a big fossil lover. This was in Calgary, up in Canada, a guy excavating a basement spotted what he knew were fossils, and he kept them from being destroyed. He called for a paleontologist, and it turns out they're 60 million year old bony fish, and that's from a period when things were really exploding in the evolutionary sense because dinosaurs had just gone extinct. What's ironic is that this guy is apparently involved with a creationist museum in the area, one that seems to have exhibits about how humans and dinosaurs coexisted. So they really take a very revisionist stance on the fossils that they study. And he's very into fossils and said that he hopes that the university will give him a cast of one of the fossils he found for the museum to his museum to hold. And, you know, it was a really important story to me because I think a lot of people assume that people who don't believe in evolution and don't support a lot of science just don't understand it. But the truth is that lots of people who are anti-science don't think of themselves that way. They think that mainstream science is wrong, and they study fossils and come to different conclusions. And that's a lot trickier to persuade.
Yeah, well, he thinks that the Earth is only 6,000 years old.
Well, that's what the
museum... So the fossil can't be any more than 6,000 years old. And
right.
And his response is something like, well, there's no label on it.
Right, there's no date stamp
on it.
Which is true. And I've actually learned from several reader emails that I've gotten that a lot of people who are creationists just think that carbon dating and other really basic tenets of geology are just wrong. And if you think all that is wrong, then, yeah, it's very easy to rewrite the entire fossil record.
Yeah, well, it's That's another topic for another day. Well, you have another fossil story about dinos being warm-blooded?
Right. So last year, a study came out that looked at all of the dinosaurs that we've studied metabolically, you know, trying to figure out how they grew and how their metabolisms worked, which it's very few. It's only a couple dozen dinosaurs, with a bunch of modern animals to try to determine what their metabolisms were like, whether they were warm-blooded, meaning that they can self-regulate body temperature, or cold-blooded, meaning they were, you know, prey to their environment's temperature. And that study last year said that they were somewhere in the middle, that they probably could regulate their temperature enough to have kind of quick muscle and nerve reactions, but that their metabolism would have been very slow to allow them to eat very little food. But a different researcher looked at the same evidence and looked at the bone rings on dinosaur bones, which are a lot like tree rings. You can measure their growth because they lay down layers of bone when they're growing a lot, and it pauses when they're not. And he says that the rate that dinosaurs grow could only be supported by a true warm-blooded mammal metabolism. But he also says that we've studied the metabolisms of so few dinosaurs that even though he really believes that the evidence we have points to them being warm-blooded, we have a lot more to learn about how their metabolisms worked.
Especially if you think a chicken is a dinosaur.
Well, they are.
Yeah, exactly. So they're warm-blooded.
Right, right.
So why not the dinosaurs? All right, let's go on to your last one, the really humane way to kill a toad.
Yes, a cane toad. So this was a really fun story. This ecologist in Australia named Rick Shine, he did a study to figure out the most humane way to kill a cane toad.
Because?
Because they are incredibly invasive in Australia. There are something like 200 million of them. They were brought in to kill this pest that eats sugar cane. The problem is that cane toads secrete this really strong poison. It irritates human skin and eyes and kills a lot of animals that try to eat them. So they really have no predators. There are tons of them, and people don't really want them around because they can irritate the skin. And right now, the recommendation is that you hit them over the head with a baseball bat. And Professor Shine thinks that's not a great idea because if you miss, you're going to cause them a lot of pain and possibly get squirted with some poison.
Or hit your toe or something.
Right. So he went back to this old method that has been kind of poo-pooed by animal rights people, which is that you put them in the fridge and then put them in the freezer because some people say, oh, if their extremities freeze before their brain shuts down, it hurts them. He put some, you know, little neurosensors on their brain to keep track of how quickly their brain shut down. And he says, for sure, they do not feel pain. And the way to get rid of your cane toads, Australia, is to turn them into toadsicles.
All right. Something to add to the rabbit problem.
Yes.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks for having
me. Rachel Feltman runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post, and she was here in our New York studios. Next up, time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Our story this week is a controversial new telescope planned atop Mauna Kea on the Big Island in Hawaii, the 30-meter telescope. Some native Hawaiians don't want to see the project go ahead, citing religious and environmental concerns. Astronomers, on the other hand, are eager to get a better eye on the sky from on high. This week, Hawaii Governor David Ike came out with his proposal to reconcile the two sides. And here to tell us the good and the bad is Molly Solomon. She's a general assistant reporter, assignment reporter, at Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. She joins us from their studios today. Welcome to Science Friday, Molly.
Hi, Ira. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Give us the good thing.
Well, I think that a lot of people do see this as sort of a step in the right direction. Governor David Ige has been pretty quiet on this issue for the past month or so since he halted construction of the 30-meter telescope project back in April. But this action plan that he announced earlier this week does really lay out a basically sweeping changes for how the mountain will be managed in the future. And so I think there was a lot of acknowledgement that maybe in the past there hadn't been as much of a balance between science and culture. So I think he's really trying to bring in more voices that can sort of speak to the Hawaiian community that, you know, this is a controversial issue and a lot of people feel very strongly about it. So I think there is a lot of good in that he has set forth a very clear set of guidelines. Much of it is directed toward the University of Hawaii, who does lease the land isn't in charge of managing it. So I think in some ways, a lot of people do see this as good, that he has sort of made this direct list, basically, of things that he would like to see changed with the mountain.
And the bad thing?
Well, I think that sort of depends on who you ask. The bad thing, I think, for people that are opposed to the telescope is that he basically, along with sort of this list of things that he'd like to see changed, he also did endorse the 30-meter telescope and basically did say that it has every right to proceed with construction. So opponents of the telescope see that as a bad thing because they don't want to see the telescope there at all. They're also a little concerned that, you know, some of the things that he did bring up might not necessarily be new, and they kind of see his statements as a little hollow, that he cares about, you know, preserving the land and caring for this mountain, but at the same time he's also endorsing the construction of this giant telescope, which is sort of the basis of the conflict that's happening right now. So they're kind of unclear that his message is really going to change the situation that's going on with the protesters at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's also been some fear, I'd say, among astronomers who are concerned with some of the language that's being used in the list of, you know, demands that he laid out earlier this week. One of them, it does say that they would like to sort of reduce the length for the lease, that the master lease would be extended for the telescope. So I think some astronomers are worried that that could send the message that Hawaii might not be a reliable place to invest in when it comes to astronomy.
How long a lease are they talking about?
Well, right now, we have a lease that is in place until 2033, or they do, but it would be extended. The basic time is 65 years. That's sort of what it is now. And so if it were to be reduced by, I'd say, 50 years, that might not be a big deal. But if it's reduced to 25 years, that could be a really big deal, especially if the 30-meter telescope is going to be up by 2025 or so. So it's, you know, if you're putting that much money into a $1.4 billion telescope and the length of the master lease isn't that long, I mean, I would be a little concerned about my funding sources.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Molly. That's a great summary. Thanks for joining us this week.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Ira.
Molly Solomon, she's a general assignments reporter at Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. We're going to take a break, and after the break, Lucy may have company. Lucy, the fossil, that is, she may have, I don't know, Ethel and Fred may be close by. We'll find out. Stay with us. Did you know you can refinance your student loans, save thousands, and make the whole process incredibly easy to manage? Our podcast sponsor this week, Earnest, has created the first radically flexible refinancing experience that can save you thousands on your student loans and put you back in control of your payment terms. Their product helps customers save an average of more than $12,500, with rates starting as low as 1.9% APR. Earnest never charges any fees, and that means no penalties for paying off your loan quickly and no charges for origination or changing your terms down the line. You can set your own terms, change your payment amount and date, or even skip a payment, all with a few clicks at meetearnest.com. Earnest can do this because they're a new kind of lender, one that looks at things traditional banks don't, like your potential, to give you the lowest possible rates. Earnest will never pass you off to a third party. Their on-site team is your customer service partner for the life of your loan. It takes less than 2 minutes to find out how much you can save, and they have a special offer for you listeners. You'll get $150 cash back when you refinance through meetearnest.com/Friday. So don't get stuck paying more than you have to. Check out meetearnest.com/Friday to take control and quickly see your personalized rates today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Here's some news to chew on. Upper and lower jaw fossils discovered in the Afar region of Ethiopia could mean Lucy, remember Lucy, had a neighbor. Lucy, or Australopithecus afarensis, long considered the lone ancestor to modern humans. This new finding suggests that the Lucys could have had a next-door neighbor, maybe Fred and Ethel Mertz of her time. The finding is published in the journal Nature this week. Joining me now is the scientist who uncovered these fossils, Johannes Haile Selassie. He's also a curator and head of physical anthropology at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. He joins us today from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Good to have you back. Also, Fred Spoor, he's a paleontologist based at University College London. He wrote a perspective on the findings in Nature. Welcome to the program. Good to have you back, Fred.
Good evening or good afternoon.
Either way. Haile Selassie, tell us about this new find. What makes it so interesting?
Well, what makes it so interesting is the fact that it coexisted with Lucy's species Australopithecus afarensis in close proximity in the Afar region of Ethiopia. So that's what makes it really interesting.
How different is it from Lucy in terms of the finding itself? Is it similar? What are the features that maybe are alike and not alike?
Well, there are definitely some similarities because they're related to each other. But, of course, what I want to mention is, first of all, when we name species based on fossils, it is usually a judgment call. So it's not like naming an existing species. And in our opinion, the differences we saw between Francis and the new species Australopithecus deiremida warrant a separation at the species level. So if we had to include the Brutellia specimens that we assigned to this new species into Australopithecus afarensis, then the amount of variation in Australopithecus afarensis would be extremely unusual, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Mm-hmm. So even though some of our colleagues may disagree with the naming, they have to disagree, you know, logically and with evidence, and not because it doesn't bode well with their long-held ideas. So we have about 14 specimens from the Brutella area, although we included in the new species two lower jaws and two upper jaws. And we have a good reason for this. And in simple terms, we're being cautious. We want to find more complete specimens that are in clear association, particularly with the partial foot, which we published in Nature 3 years ago. And I think this is important because as it stands right now, the Brutellia partial foot cannot be assigned to Australopithecus afarensis. Afarensis is thought to be like to have been fully bipedal in the human way. And the best evidence for this are the Laetoli footprints from Tanzania. So at the same time, we have not seen any species that is like the 4.4-million-year-old Ardipithecus-like in terms of its locomotor adaptation, but Australopithecus-like in its teeth and jaw morphology. Mm-hmm. So the new species might be the first with such unusual combination, and this would be a great discovery in paleoanthropology. However, we want to make sure that this is true by finding more complete fossils in clear association with the foot. For us, at least for at this time, the isolated teeth that we have associated with the foot are not enough for this association. So the most important point, I think, is that if the Brutellia specimens belong to Lucy's species, Australopithecus afarensis, as something, then the species may have to, you know, lose its integrity as we know it today. And separating the Laetoli material from the Hadamard material might be necessary, okay? So this is the situation we're in right now. Mm-hmm. And I think the new species, Australopithecus deiremida, it's not going to be a trivia question on bad anthropology exam or something, but I think it's going to be here and it's going to stay.
Let me ask Fred Sport, if there are two separate species there now, as Johannes thinks, could there be more than just two? I mean, haven't we seen stone tools now that are being dug up that might say there are more kinds of species than just the two of them?
It's certainly possible, and I should directly admit to having a vested interest in this, because in 2001, together with my colleague Niamh Leakey and other colleagues, we described a species from western the west side of Lake Turkana that we, in the same way, we seriously think is different from Australopithecus afarensis, and we named it as Kenyanthropus platyops, meaning the flat-faced human from Kenya. So that's the difference from Johannes Haile Selassie's and colleagues' find, is that that's really quite far away from where Australopithecus afarensis was living. What makes that particular new species that is from about the same time frame as the new species that has just been announced, what's interesting there is that indeed exactly in the same place from the same sites these stone tools have been found a week ago. So in that case, there's at least a suspicion that Kenyanthropus platyops might have been the tool user.
So then you might have a whole diverse group of living in the same time at the same place.
It's not that unusual. If we think about human evolution and we really take a broad view, then we know that the last common ancestor with chimpanzees was about 6, 7, 8 million years old. It's a bit variable. If we then talk about the time period between 3 and 4, that's really only halfway. And it would be actually really remarkably unusual if you would get an incredible lack of species diversity all the way to well beyond the halfway point in human evolution, and then at 2.5 or 3 million years ago, you suddenly would have a burst into different species. It seems to me most logical that this diversity in species would have been going on for a long time before that, and the fact that we didn't find that much has more to do with where were we looking, in what kind of earth layers, in what kind of regions of mm-hmm. the world, or in this case, of what regions of Africa. So it's an artifact of finding fossils and not so much of what was really going on.
Johannes, could the Lucy species and your new hominin have crossed paths, perhaps?
Well, we don't know enough about we don't know enough yet to say anything about, you know, the nature of interaction or ecological differences between Australopithecus afarensis and Australopithecus deiromeda at this time. In order to understand these aspects, we have to distinguish them from each other first. And that's what we did in this Nature publication.
Mm-hmm. Does it mean that, there was talk that that Lucy was sort of the sole lineage backwards. Now we're saying maybe perhaps it casts doubt on whether modern humans actually descended from Lucy or from some other species?
Well, it's quite possible, but I have to say that the idea of just Lucy being the only ancestor was based on the old single species hypothesis, okay, which suggested that early hominins had broad adaptive niche because they ate anything that they could digest and required vast area as their home range. But as Fred mentioned earlier, this has been proven wrong because we have multiple taxa living, you know, around 2.5 to 0.4 million years ago, and I don't know why it's really a surprise if we had such a diversity 3.3, 3.5 million years ago. So Lucy was thought to be the only ancestor that gave rise to all these later hominins, but now with discoveries, additional discoveries from the same time from Ethiopia and Kenya, make them like probable ancestors. Now we have competitors, so it's not just Lucy's species, Australopithecus afarensis, that could be considered as the probable ancestor, our ancestor.
Do you have any further bones that you have in possession that you're digging up with your new species that might give us a more complete skeleton?
Well, we don't know. As you know, the fossil evidence is always full of surprises. We just don't know what we're going to find next, but we keep looking for them every field season we go. And sometimes when we're lucky, we find, you know, good specimens, sometimes isolated teeth. So that's how it goes in our field.
Mm-hmm. And Fred, any last words on where this is all headed? Any new review of our ancestry?
Well, it will certainly sort of sharpen the minds again for people to look at this whole period between 3 and 4 million, and with the look at the fossil record again with a bit more open mind and see what was going on. In terms of ancestry, I still think that of the three species that we've now talked about, of between, let's say, 3 and 3.5, that Australopithecus afarensis is the most primitive of those three and the most likely ancestor. But that doesn't matter. What is really fascinating for me is that you just really see how different species evolved related to different environments and perhaps different diets, and you can see that reflected in the way their jaws are formed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to thank you both for taking time out of your busy days and evenings to talk with us. I wish you great luck in your further research. We'll be following it.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Johannes Haile Selassie, thanks. He's curator and head of physical anthropology at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. Fred Spohr, Dr. Spohr, is a paleontologist based at University College in London. The International Space Station has hundreds of experiments on board, testing everything from how plants grow in space to the effects of microgravity on an astronaut's eyes. But NASA may have scored the ultimate, the controlled test with test subjects Scott and Mark Kelly, twin astronauts. NASA sent Scott up to the space station and they kept Mark here on the ground, and they're going to be testing what a full year of zero gravity will do to the body compared to Mark staying here on the ground. And we have one of the pair joining us now. Mark Kelly is a NASA astronaut based out of Tucson. He joins us from KUAZ Studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. I want to invite our listeners, if they have questions for you about living in space, our number 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Tell us how it feels to have your twin up there circling overhead while you're down here.
Well, you know, we've been doing this kind of thing for a long time, you know, over 15 years now. So it's not unusual. He's been there before. Like I have, but this time it's a bit different at a year. So he's got a long road ahead of him.
How did you both as twins get to be astronauts?
We were both Navy test pilots. You know, before that we both flew, you know, aircraft off of an aircraft carrier. So we've had similar careers, and like most test pilots do, we applied for the astronaut program.
And how do you communicate with Scott while he's up there on the space station?
Well, you know, you can't call up, but he has a phone. There is a couple of them, in fact, internet phones that are connected to computers, and he can make a phone call from space to anywhere on Earth. So he calls me on my cell phone.
And it rings, it says what on your cell phone?
Well, so it's a number from Houston, Texas, one of several numbers, and my daughter Claire, who is a senior in high school, just graduated, she programmed it, or she put it in there, my contact. So it says space, and there's a picture of an alien and a rocket ship.
Claire did that to you, huh?
Yeah.
Tell us what a bit about life in space. If you're up there, if your brother is up there for a year, does he have to know how to be a doctor, a self-doctor, and you know, is he drawing blood samples for comparison with you down here on Earth and things like that, sort of medical things he needs to know?
You know, to be a space station crew member for an extended period of time like that, whether it's 6 months or a year, you've got to be everything, right? You're the plumber, you're the mechanic, you're the scientist, you know, you're the secretary, you're the cleaning person, you're the doctor or the nurse. But to answer your question, yes, he draws his own blood in space. He could have another crew member do it. Which is often the case. My brother finds it's easier if he just does it himself. And then those samples go back to Earth, often on a SpaceX spacecraft.
Talking with Mark Kelly, astronaut on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And how eagerly do you await these cargo ships as they come to this space station?
Well, I think they're eagerly awaiting the next one, which I think might be at the end of June. And the reason is that we recently lost a Progress resupply vehicle going up to the space station. It launched. It had some major issues, maybe an explosion. I don't think they're exactly sure yet. And it never docked with the space station, and it had a lot of food and clothing on board. So now they have to reprioritize all the resupply flights. So they're looking forward to this one.
Any priceless personal effects that might be?
You know, I think there are a couple things for my brother, not anything just because of where the care packages go up, right? You get to send stuff up to people in space, just like you would send them, you know, cookies if they were overseas, maybe. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of do the same thing. But the most important thing that I sent him is on the next spacecraft.
You won't share that with us.
No.
I didn't think so.
You might hear about it later.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, we'll turn the dial up to 11 on that one. I have a question here from a tweet that came in from Hugh Fetzer, who questions, does your brother have an exit clause in his one-year contract? Is there,
is there a secret word he says?
Yeah. I mean, is there a medical emergency or a psychological emergency that could send you home early?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my brother certainly isn't going to have the psychological emergency. I guarantee that. But there's always for any crew member in space, you could have a serious medical problem. I mean, one thing we really worried about with people is getting kidney stones. Often you get dehydrated in space because the way the fluid shifts in your body. and people are more susceptible to dehydration, which makes you more susceptible to getting something like a kidney stone.
Right.
So we worry about that. I mean, that could be an issue where you would have to bring somebody home. But there, as you know, there's so many other things. But it's, you know, it's typically reserved to a serious medical problem, and they can get home pretty quickly. You know, you could climb in the Soyuz and button it up and undock and, you know, be back on Earth in a number of hours if you had to.
Let's go to a quick phone call before we go to the break. Let's go to Jacob in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question for Mark. Is NASA asking you to restrict your physical activities so that it mirrors that of your brothers on the International Space Station as part of this experiment?
Good question.
You know, we talked about that, and they were actually more concerned with me not making big changes in my own physical conditioning from what it was before. So I did a lot of pre-flight testing, a lot of blood, MRIs, ultrasounds, some stuff. I'm not even sure what I was doing. You know, they didn't want me to make big changes. So I'm not matching what he does with diet or exercise. I'm more being consistent.
All right. Nice call.
Gotcha.
One last question before the break. Who's got the better right stuff, Mark? You or
like
Scott?
Like being a better pilot?
Well, a better astronaut.
Better astronaut? I don't, you know. I'd say we both do adequate jobs.
Okay. Wait till you hear what your brother said. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Scott Kelly aboard the International Space Station earlier today when we had time to do it after his first 2 months in space. We're going to hear from him and more with Mark after the break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast listeners. This is Ariel, Science Friday's education manager. In Science Club, we challenge you to go out, do science, and share it with others. And since this time we're asking you to explain the sun, we thought it'd help to have a pair of new shades. So for a limited time, if you make a donation of $10, we'll send you a pair of Stylin Science Friday sunglasses. They're 100% IRA approved and offer UV protection against the harsh rays, but you still shouldn't look straight at the sun. Go to sciencefriday.com/donate to make your gift today, and visit sciencefriday.com/scienceclub for more info on our Explain the Sun challenge.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with astronaut Mark Kelly. He's part of NASA's year-long twin study with his brother Scott, who was up on the International Space Station, been up there a few months. If you have questions about living in space, our number 844-724-8255 or 844-SciTalk. We have quite a number of tweets that have come in. I'm sure you're used to this, Mark. First from Sherry, she said, I've heard the equipment on the space station can be quite loud. What is the background noise level like?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is, it's pretty noisy. And some places are noisier than others. I would say the quietest place is in the Japanese experiment module, the GEM that I brought up in 2008, I think. And other places, it's pretty loud. It's you know, it could get a little uncomfortable, and it affects people's hearing long term. So that's a continuing problem. But like any vehicle that needs an environmental system, you're going to have pumps and fans and those things, and there's not a lot you can do about it.
Daniel Yao asks, what do you think about bringing on China as a partner to the International Space Station community?
That is a great question and a big question and a geopolitical question. You know, we've had that discussion at NASA, and I think there are some people at times that think that would be a great thing to do, you know, to offset some of the costs. These things are expensive to do. And our relationship, you know, with Russia, you know, it's not always great, but I think it's often better because of our cooperation in space. You know, personally, I think it's beneficial to us to cooperate with as many countries as possible. But this is this is a question for our leaders in Washington, D.C.
As they say, above your pay grade. In D.C. Isn't there a law, Congress passed a law against cooperating solely with China in space?
I think that's correct. Yes, yeah. Several years ago, I think that actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we've got a couple of more questions here to go to. Somebody asks, the Black Files asks, do astronauts ever gain weight up there? If so, why?
Yeah, no, people generally lose weight. I do. I mean, for a number of reasons. One is, you know, you might not be very hungry the first few days of a space shuttle flight. You also don't have time, you know. and the portion size is pretty small, and it's well controlled. So normally people do lose weight. Not everybody. Yeah. I don't know of many cases where people gained weight.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to go now to earlier this morning, an interview I did with Scott Kelly. We had to wait until there was a window with uninterrupted space-to-ground satellite communications, and here's how that went.
Please stand by for a voice check from PRI Science Friday.
Hi there. Station, this is PRI Science Friday. How do you hear me?
I have you loud and clear. Welcome aboard the International Space Station.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us. Scott, your longest mission before this was 159 days. How do you compare that mission? Do you have a different mindset that you do for a whole year versus 3-4 months?
You know, absolutely. So last time I was here a little bit more than 5 months. When when it's that duration, at least in my case, you can kind of see the end of it from the beginning. I launched in October, got home in March, and you just look, you know, you look at it on almost as a month-to-month basis, you know, get through November, Thanksgiving, December, Christmas, and then the New Year's, and pretty soon it's almost time to come home. This time it's much different. You know, I know I'll come home someday, but from my perspective, I live and work here now. I'm going to be here for a long time, and as such, I just kind of have to pace myself.
Mm. We talked to Don Pettit a little while back about the zero-gravity cups and espresso maker. Have you been clinking your coffee cups up there?
You know, we used Don's cup that he designed when we used the espresso maker early on once we had it hooked up. I was surprised at how well it actually worked. I didn't think it would make it seem like you were drinking out of a cup. It's pretty clever design. But we don't have a whole lot of those capsules for the espresso machine, so we haven't used it in a while, and hopefully we will. And Samantha's throwing a cup at me real quick to show you. So here's the cup, and yeah, like I said, it's pretty incredible how when you go like this, it actually seems to pour with gravity, even though there's no gravity. But haven't used it much, but look forward to using it again.
We spoke to Julie Robinson from Johnson, and she mentioned something called suction pants. That has to do with how microgravity affects your vision. Have you been able to try them out? Have you noticed that your vision is affected by long-term microgravity?
Well, that's the first I've heard of that term. It could be something that I had not had training on, or something that's going to come in the future. I guess what she's probably talking about is mitigating the fluid shift that occurs. You know, gravity on Earth pushes a lot of the fluid, you know, out of your head towards your feet, and up here it's just all redistributed. So you generally have a higher pressure in your head, and that's why some astronauts, me included, when they first get up here, they kind of have a puffy head, and that kind of continues. As far as my vision, you know, it seems like my middle vision is and distance vision is a little bit better. My reading vision's a little bit worse. You know, it varies from time to time up here. You know, I did have some little bit of structural changes last time, and I'm sure I'll have that this time. And, you know, it's part of the price that some people pay for going up here, and we're trying to understand it better and understand the risks and how to mitigate those risks. And hopefully some of the experiments we're doing on board, even next week, will help us do that.
The Russians had a cosmonaut up there for 14 months. Did you talk to him? Did he give you any hints or tips about what to expect?
I did not talk to him. I don't think I've ever met him, but I did talk to Vladimir Titov, who spent about a year in space on the Mir space station. And he gave me, one bit of advice, and it's just like, it was basically just pace yourself. You know, you're going to be there for a long time. And just, try to keep a good balance of work and rest, and you'll do just fine.
We're speaking to your brother Mark today also. Now, which one of you has the better right stuff? Is there a sibling rivalry in space?
That would be me.
Why am I not surprised?
I'm sure he would say the same thing. You know, We are, and I'm just kidding around. I have no idea. You know, we're similar in a lot of ways, different in others. We're, you know, naturally competitive people, but not competitive with, between each other. Our experiences in space have been a little bit different, but we both recognize that just having the ability to fly in space once is a real privilege, and, it's just really been an incredible thing that we could share together. This great experience, and both of us having flown four times is really hard to believe.
I know he's on the ground here comparing what happens to him during your time up there in space. Have you two noticed any differences already that you can compare?
Well, most of that comparative research is with samples of blood and urine and other things, and cognitive ability, some cognitive experiments using MRIs and, structural changes within our bodies and the chemistry of our bodies, our genetics, things like that. So there's stuff that you don't see that the researchers at some point will publish papers on, for instance, how my DNA looked one way before flight and how his compared before flight, and then maybe how mine changed over time while I was here, where his, in a certain area stayed the same. But that's not stuff that we can see at this point, but, stuff that's very important nonetheless.
We asked our listeners what questions they had for you, and we have a couple of them from Twitter. I'm going to see if I can share them with you. David Shee wanted to know if the likelihood of infection is higher on Earth or on ISS, and is there an effect on your microbiome, and are you measuring that too?
Yeah, so one of the studies we're doing with my brother is a microbiome study, how our microbiome changes. And the microbiome, for people that might not be familiar with it, is, all this bacteria that resides within your digestive system. And apparently, from what I understand, there's more of those cells that aren't you than there are of your own human cells. So it's, it's critical to our physiology. It's very important, and it does change when we're in space. And we're comparing that, the changes in my microbiome with my brother's over the period of time that we're here. And as getting back to the first part of your question about infections, our immune system generally is depressed up here for, I'm not sure why. Maybe someone knows exactly why, but we actually are studying that. So in some respects, I would guess you would be, a little bit more prone to certain types of infections, things that we have on board here that can infect you. But for instance, there's no cold virus up here, the flu virus, things like that. Certain types of bacteria, we don't have them on the space station. Therefore, people generally don't get sick like you might on Earth, at least not very often.
All right, Scott, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, and it was great talking to you today.
Station, this is Houston ACR. Thank you. That concludes our event.
And thank you, Science Friday. Station, we are now resuming operational audio communications.
Thanks, Kathy.
Great job.
And that was my chat with astronaut Mark Kelly earlier today, Scott Kelly, I'm sorry, living up in the space station. I have with me on the phone, on our ISDN line, is Mark Kelly. What do you think of that interview? Were you, did you learn anything from it, Mark?
Was I supposed to be listening? I didn't think there was going to be a quiz. I hear from him all the time.
I'll bet. Are you keeping track of your microbiome? We follow that a lot on this program.
Well, I mailed NASA a sample recently, so I think they are.
They should. We have a couple of more questions coming in before we run out of time. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Mark Kelly right here about living in space. Let's see if we can get a couple of phone calls in, if you don't mind. Let's go to Rob in Brookings, South Dakota. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
I have kind of a less scientific question. I know you guys stay pretty busy up there, but what sort of pranks do you play on each other when you have time?
You know, we made practical jokes illegal in the astronaut office. There's actually a rule against that. They've had some bad experiences, and sometimes, you know, it's not an environment, but I'm sure on the space station, you know, where people are living for long periods of time, there probably is a little bit of that. And, you know, my own experience with playing a practical joke on one of my crew members once didn't go so well. So I certainly understand the reason that the astronaut office discourages it.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call. Is there anything that's missing from the space station that you would like to have as a piece of hardware or something, you know, that is not there that you say, hey, you know, I wish they had put this on?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, we have a couple treadmills on board, a weightlifting machine, a bike. Swimming pool would be nice. It'd be hard to keep the water in.
Is there a big screen TV up there?
You know, my brother got manifested a very small high-definition projector and a screen to do primarily video teleconferences. But at the same time, you know, you could also watch movies on it. And he recently tweeted a picture of them watching the movie Gravity, which had Sandra Bullock going through a hatch on the space station, and the screen is at that same spot in that hatch. Hmm. So it's pretty interesting to see the photo.
You know, I noticed the tragic weather that you're having in Texas with the flooding and the deaths. But up there in space for 6 months, do you ever just miss the weather? It's the same every
day.
Well,
so, you know, my brother has talked about that during his last mission, you know, his last space flight, which was 6 months. I've only done a short, you know, short duration space shuttle flight, so that's not really a factor for me. He has mentioned that a number of times, that the one thing he misses is the wind and the rain, because on the space station, you know, it's pretty consistent, low humidity. Well, at least in the U.S. segment, mm-hmm. It's a little higher humidity in the Russian segment, but it's, you know, the temperatures are really consistent, so it's same every day.
Mm-hmm. How is the adjustment process? What do you go through when you get back?
Well, your body has to readjust, even from a short duration flight. You know, 2 days after you get back, you're incredibly sore. It's kind of like if you've never lifted weights before, and then you went and did a bunch of squats, you know, with a lot of weight. You kind of feel like that a couple days later. Your neurovestibular system's a little messed up, especially the first day. People have a habit, as they turn corners, of running into walls. So you can't drive a car for a while. After a year, I don't know how long it'll be for my brother before they allow him to drive a car again. It might be a month. So your body has to go through this readjustment phase. And I think it, you know, to get back to 100%, it's typically about as much time as you were in space is the recovery time.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Mark.
And, great speaking to you, Ira. Thank you.
And good luck with the project, and the best wishes to Gabby from us all here, too.
I'll tell her. Thank you.
We've like to also thank Scott Kelly for joining us earlier from the International Space Station, and also NASA for hooking us up to the space station, too. One last thing. We see sunlight every day, but what might the sun sound like? You're listening to the effect of a few dozen resonances, different sound waves bouncing back and forth inside the sun. Astronomers at Stanford use an instrument called the Michelson Doppler Imager on the SOHO spacecraft to track surface oscillations made by those ricocheting sound waves, sort of a solar seismograph. Let's listen to a little bit of it. This is 40 days worth of that data, filtered and cleaned and sped up by 42,000 times to make it audible. This is just a few dozen of some 10 million resonances going on inside the sun right now. Alexander Kozovichev took those readings and got that tweaked up for us. And as a reminder, we want to use this as a reminder to help our Science Club explain the sun. Go to sciencefriday.com/scienceclub for details. And for the kitchen geek in you, our final sun activity is set up to model a convection that occurs on the surface of the sun. And you can model it in your kitchen. Check out sciencefriday.com/convection. That's about all the time we have for today. You can email us at sci-fry@sciencefriday.com. We want to thank our Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here at the studios of our production partner, the City University of New York, Rich Kim,